This week I have with me Sean Hogan, one of the designers and the programmer for Anodyne. Could you give us just a brief synopsis of what Anodyne is?
Yeah, sure. So Anodyne is this adventure game set in a dream world, this character. And the gameplay, you explore like a series of dungeons inside the stream world, and at the same time you also explore a series of these areas that are a little less hostile. And this exploration forms a bit of a narrative for the main character, who is inside of their dream world. So it's a game with a focus on, you know, exploration and then also more like combat puzzly stuff. And it's been compared to Zelda and Yume Nikki and some of the other 16-bit era adventure games.
And you mentioned combat right at the end there, which is why you're here today. You were talking about bosses this week, and Anodyne actually has some interesting boss fights. So I was wondering, what was your basic process for making a boss from conception to completion?
Yeah, so with the bosses in Anodyne, it always started with a bare mechanic, and the mechanic for the boss, sometimes it stemmed from a lot of the mechanics that happen in a dungeon. So, you know, with one of the bosses, you were riding around on the little dust raft a lot, so I wanted to design the boss to use that as part of the fight. And then from that mechanic, I would go ahead and test that up by itself and then see, you know, is that too easy, is it too hard? If it's too easy, then, you know, I would add some other mechanics around it, sort of to keep the player moving, so it wouldn't be a total cakewalk. And then after that's all finished and the boss works, then I would design out the aesthetics for the boss, so sort of what it looks like and how it relates to the area. And that worked okay for the most part. I think an ideal still would have been to design the aesthetic of the boss first and then make the mechanics from there, but I'm not sure how big of a difference that would have made. But the way I did it from Anodyne was from mechanics to aesthetics.
Okay. You mentioned that sometimes the mechanics stem from the dungeons and sometimes not. What was the deciding factor in that?
So the first three dungeons, in a way, are there to sort of just teach some basic things with, like, you know, writing the dust around or jumping or, you know, manipulating the dust. And so I guess when I was designing those dungeons, I had the idea in mind to make the boss fights focus a lot more on using those mechanics. So the first three bosses, at least, you know, were definitely, you know, they're based around placing dust or jumping or rafting. I don't know how about the later bosses, if you want me to talk about it, but...
We don't mind spoilers, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So the last three bosses, those three dungeons, I think one of them really has like a specific brand new mechanic, and that boss does use that one. Which are these like sort of like speed up pads, which make you run a little faster. The other two, they were more of me just like exploring, jumping and the other mechanics to sort of fit the aesthetic of the dungeon. So those were less explicitly designed around a single one. They were more of just like a, you know, a boss fight that I thought might be interesting.
Okay. I also noticed that you mentioned bosses have a lot going on, and in my personal experience, I just beat the third boss, which, you know, spews a ton of bullets at you and then has hands slamming around the room at the same time. How did you balance all these things going on at the same time?
So a lot of those things, they combine all of those mechanics to keep the player moving and not make the fight, you know, super boring. You want to kind of have like an energy to the fight and keep it exciting. For balancing it, so you plan out like a, you plan the boss mechanics on paper, and, you know, kind of sanity check it there and see if it looks okay. And then you go into the game, you program it, and, you know, you play the boss a few times, and, you know, if it feels right, then, you know, it's probably going to be fine. With that boss, I don't remember specifically because that was a while ago, but I'm pretty sure I was, like, definitely tweaking, you know, the speed of the hands or how many bullets were being shot, how far they get shot, the interval between the bullets being shot, until I got sort of the feel I wanted for the boss, which was to have to move around a bit to not take damage. That's kind of, it happens for any boss, but yeah, it's a lot of just iteration. I think from playing lots of games throughout life, that makes it a lot easier to sort of pick a spot that's pretty close to what you want. And then from there, it's just a matter of just, like, you know, messing around with the variables until it seems right.
Okay. And I guess a final word on bosses. Do you have a favorite?
Yeah. My favorite boss is not one you've played yet. It's the boss in the dungeon with the jumping puzzles that everyone hates me for. I'm sorry. I'm just listening. What it is... So that dungeon has this, like, mechanic of these, like, pads that help you, they make you run faster, so, you know, there's a bit of, like, platforming centered around that. And so that boss is, you walk around the perimeter of the room, and there's just a giant pit in the middle, and you have those little, like, dash pads, and you have to use them to catch up to the boss as it runs around the room, and, like, kind of jumps all over the place, and, you know, I like that one. I don't know. I kind of like the running fast stuff. It was fun. A lot of movement. And so that's probably my favorite, even though it's pretty easy. This is kind of like a fun fight.
Yeah, I can get behind that. And you may have noticed that Anodyne also has exploration. So I wanted to ask about that a little, because we were talking about that previously as well. In specific, I noticed that Anodyne sometimes tantalizes players with locked doors and places you can't get to, but there are also plenty of times where you just have a whole bunch of options, places you can go, but no real pointer in one specific direction. I was wondering how you balanced those two approaches.
Yeah. So, early on in design, we decided that there would only be 6 main dungeons, and that there would also be some, I guess this happened more naturally, but we also decided that we would have, you know, small parts of the other areas that were dungeon-like. You know, they'd have some enemies, or maybe have something, a prize at the end. But, so striking a balance there, I guess it came down to, like, the world design. So, you know, 3 of the dungeons are sort of located in the middle of a leg of areas, and so they form a contrast between, you know, a relatively wide open place to explore, and then the dungeon, and then the next place to sort of explore, and then there's another dungeon after that. So I think a lot of the balance is felt in that there's never 2 dungeons directly side by side. There's always a little bit of, like, breathing room for the player to, like, have one of those more wide open areas. I mean, it wasn't all, like, perfectly planned out. I guess it ended up working pretty well, you know, because people don't feel always stressed out, except for this one area that a lot of people also dislike. You haven't got to it yet. kind of like a maze. People hate mazes.
I love mazes.
There's a clue to get to the maze without, you know, stressing out, but I guess it's hard to understand, so. Yeah, so a lot of balance is, I don't know, it was planned out, and we were kind of hoping it would work, and it works. It always seemed to work okay. So a lot of it is just, like, an intuition you kind of build up from playing games a lot, and just, I guess, thinking a lot about the area's relations to each other. It's kind of a weird answer, but yeah, it wasn't totally, like, an explicit thought-out process, but more of a series of, like, educated guesses, maybe?
I think I get you. There's definitely a sense of pacing to the exploration where as you explore more, you get more definite ideas of where to go.
Mm-hmm.
So I was also wondering, for one particularly compelling segment, you kill a man in a river and then explore the bloodied waters. But that's a fairly short segment. On the other hand, a large amount of time is spent in a normal environment. It's just a seaside woodsy area. So I was wondering, what role did aesthetics play in exploration? You have this really interesting set piece, but you also have this really sort of normal one.
Yeah. So aesthetics sort of meant to carry this sort of overlying, like, unspoken kind of narrative to the dream, because it isn't a dream, and think of it as like a dream sequence, you know. So in the first areas of the game, their aesthetics are very cliche, but like based in fantasy or so. You know, you have your like weird white area, then giant hub of portals, and then everything's sort of darkish, kind of like entering a dream. And then we contrast that with all of those nature areas. And like the division of the world into different like sets of aesthetics, like very complementary or more like generic RPG-ish or very, you know, abstract, which is after the nature-ish areas. That's sort of done to, it's done to give a sense of pacing for the exploration, right? So you don't want to, you can always have this lot of like nature areas to come back to. And that also ties in to sort of the character's process of exploring that dream world. You know, they go through sort of like more calm thoughts and kind of like darker sorts of thoughts that don't pervade the entire dream world completely. So it's kind of a weird mix of, you know, pacing and also like some, like an unspoken, like narrative, the world design and all the aesthetics and how the areas juxtapose to each other. Yeah, like it's something I'd like to talk about and like very concretely get my thoughts down, because it's a big part of the game, and, I guess I'm still like understanding it too, which is kind of strange.
Maybe you designed it in your sleep? It sounds like the key is to have the interesting parts be the small parts, so that you allow room for the player to think on their own about it. You don't want to say too much yourself.
Yeah. yeah, like that's a. It's a. I mean, what we're interested in seeing how that works with the players. You know, we give them. You know, so there's sort of that, like, base story going on, and that's kind of wrapped up, like, a little bit, but, you know, most people just end up being frustrated that nothing's tied up for them, or there's too many, like, things to interpret. So I guess that's kind of, that is our fault. But I guess I'm glad, because, you know, so, it means that we did design the world well enough that it made people think, and they did come to some conclusions. And I do think that was helped by there not being a giant story, you know, thrown at you every few minutes. So in that way, even if, you know, people don't come to like a complete conclusion, I think they can still like take something away from the game, which is nice.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever heard anyone call it Lynchian, so there's that.
Wait, David's a filmmaker, right?
Yeah. He's Eraserhead and Doom.
I've heard that name thrown around a bit with respect to Anodyne. I think people said it was like borderline that, and I'm very like ignorant to film, which is bad, because I never get around to watching them. Like, I have friends that are like, you should watch this film, and I'm like, okay, I will. But I'm working on this, so, but...
David Lynch makes very purposely confusing movies.
Yeah, I mean, I can see, like, nothing in Anodyne is like purposely intended to be confusing. If it's confusing, I guess you know, I guess we're just bad at laying out, you know, the pieces to, like, sort of puzzle together and interpret. I guess, no, I mean, it was our first time sort of doing something this big, and it would have been nice to have made everything a little more concrete. I guess it does come off as a little bit too confusing, which isn't what we wanted. Like, we wanted there to be room for interpretation, but we didn't want it to be, you know, making people totally lost. But, you know, I guess, you know, it's the first, we don't have much experience of doing that, so I guess it's natural for it to sort of come off as confusing, and I guess Lynchian. Oh, we tried, and...
Well, that's all people can ask for. So, final word on Anodyne. You said you were on Steam Greenlight?
Yeah. We are on Steam Greenlight, and it's interesting because, you know, after the Pirate Bay weekend, we shot up quite a bit, I think to like 60th place, and over the past week we've continued rising, and I think we're at 46th right now. And, you know, normally they usually take the top 10 or whatever and greenlight them, and the next greenlight date is happening this Tuesday, the 26th. But what's interesting is that some games like Primordia by, have been greenlit because they were rising pretty quickly in the past few weeks. So it's not really guaranteed that we'd get greenlit, but there's still some weird glimmer of hope because we have been rising pretty quickly, and like the current demand like on Steam for the game is like pretty high. So I mean, it might happen. I guess we'll see.
Well,
I'm just trying not to think about it too much.
Anodyne runs on my Windows XP from 2006, so it's got my vote.
Oh, good.
All right, thanks for coming on the show, Sean Hogan.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.